There's a certain amount, I think, in my position of feeling a little bit isolated. I'm in daily interactions with the team. We chat quite a bit and we have one-to-ones. But on the whole, my daily interactions are through a bunch of meetings that I kind of bounce to from one-to-one. And so in a sense, that is very isolating. But in hindsight, I think I would kind of feel that way in person too. I go to a bunch of different meetings and I get to integrate and talk to and communicate with my team members in between those. When I'm working remotely, I don't have that option.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Let's get to the real work. Today, I'm talking with Rachel Trana, Senior Engineering Manager at Grainger. Rachel has almost 15 years of experience in software, a PhD in applied math, and even, if I have this right, Rachel spent 8 years teaching computer science at the university level. And so, yeah. Rachel, we're super excited to have you on and to learn from you.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
What led you to the world of software after completing your PhD in math?
I like to say it was an accident. I was looking for jobs at the end of my PhD and wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And I came across a listing for a technical consultant. It was for a consultancy called Botworks. I didn't really know what that meant. And they had a very unique interviewing process. So I filled this very cool questionnaire. And then I had to write some code, which I wrote in MATLAB and got a response. Yeah, I got a response that was like, no one can run your code here. So I did some like quick research and rewrote it in Java. It was probably really, really terrible. And it started from there.
What's Grainger's approach to in-person versus remote work?
Grainger takes a hybrid approach. And it depends on where you currently live. So like, you know, a lot changed with the pandemic. People moved and, you know, we hired remotely. And so Grainger's approach is pretty flexible. You know, those of us that are close to the Chicago office come in twice a week. And most of my teams that I work with are hybrid. So I have people who are fully remote and I have people who are in the office. And it's designed to definitely support like growing talent. So our like more recent hires out of university come in into the Chicago office and they work in this hybrid approach, which we think really lends itself to like training them up and providing them with a cohort that they can rely on.
I'm seeing you're in an office now. What is the culture around in-person versus remote work really feel like?
It's really geared towards flexibility. And what we aim to do is that like when you're in the office, we want to make sure that like you're getting the most out of being in the office. We do have specific days that like we know that almost everyone across like our like keep stock teams, for example, are going to be in. And actually this week we have people who have flown in who are remote also. So we have like a lot of engineering. So then we have pairing stations. So like now, you know, ideally if you're in the office and your peers are in the office, you can pair together in person. It kind of facilitates conversations. We try to be very intentional around the types of things that we do in person together. So like whiteboarding sessions and event storming, brainstorming. You know, there's a little bit of a socialization that happens as well. You know, when you have people coming in. The other day that we choose, you know, I kind of leave that to my team members' schedules. Most of them choose a Tuesday or a Thursday, and they can choose an office based on their proximity to that office. So like we have team members that are much closer to Lake Forest. And so a bunch of them come in on Thursdays in like our Lake Forest office. The goal is to make the experience easy and enjoyable and, you know, flexible to accommodate work-life balance.
So this topic of when to work in person versus remote comes up a lot. And it sounds like you have some specific thoughts or ideas around the type of work that is best leveraged in person instead of remote. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Kickoffs, I think, are like one of the things that we like to organize around, making sure that like, hey, we're presenting new work to our teams. We think that a lot of times by being in person for a kickoff, it facilitates questions. We still leverage the tooling to support the hybrid approach. So even our kickoffs, you know, we encourage everyone to come in if they're able to come in, but we support our remote team members by using tools like Mural or Lucidchart or whatever like drawing software you can use and, you know, PowerPoints and things to kind of encourage those conversations, even though like we might have like some in-person things. But a lot of times like brainstorming sessions, often, like, if we want to have some of event storming. We like to do that in person. We can put up big, you know, sets of sheets of paper and walk through the event storming that way. Those are types of things that we find are a little like there's a benefit of socialization as we do it. People feel more comfortable asking questions, maybe right next to someone. There's that aspect. But in terms of working together, we use these same tools regardless of whether or not we work remotely or we work in person. So we, you know, draw things out on Mural. We draw things out on Lucid Chart.
Do you have a particular process that, you know, this is how we do kickoffs? I know it's a little bit tactical and detailed, but if you did have a particular process, I'd be super curious to hear what it was.
We're still refining it. You know, it's definitely like a work in progress. We've learned things. And it depends a little bit on the type of kickoff that we're doing. But there's something about like product has gone through and they've done then like their discovery process and they've worked with our architecture and our engineering managers and tech leads to kind of define specific like interfaces or like how we're going to do this. And then we basically say, hey, we even have a list of artifacts we need in order to like share all the context with the team. So what does that list of artifacts look like? Well, if we have API changes, we want to have plan schema changes. If we have eventing changes, we want to have those plan schemas in place, or at least be able to talk to them to a certain extent. We want to have an architecture design document that kind of details out the options that we've considered and thrown out and kept and like why we've considered it so that we can talk through the pros and cons. We want to understand the business context of like why we're doing this now, what's important, what's the scope of what we're trying to do. That scoping is really important because it allows us to kind of deliver quickly and effectively as teams. So we have these set of artifacts. And so the idea is then that we put together an agenda that basically walks through like, hey, here's the business context. Here's our user journeys. Here's the scope of what we're trying to do. And then going into that, are there any questions around the user journeys? Any questions around the scope of what we've defined and why is it, you know, in or out in terms of any particular specifics? And then, of course, the technical aspect of it. And so saying, hey, for this design, is anyone seeing anything that we've missed as we think about this? Any risks, anything that we should parking lot, anything for product that we want to call out? And we kind of take note of that. And then there's a story mapping session that happens as well as part of this kickoff of like, what are the high-level stories that we think we need to cover as part of this work so that we can get moving on it? And each team has their own story mapping session right after the larger kickoff. It is a kind of a process, but you know, and there are things that have worked and things that haven't, and we've been changing as we learn.
So what I heard is that there's a lot of upfront work between some of the product, the design, the business folks, engineering, leadership, be it managerial or technical leadership, to sort of scope out the core components of a given project. And then that gets presented in a logical way to the team so that they can engage, ask questions, and really create that shared context before then going off to deliver against that work. Did I understand that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And really highlighting to the teams, like why are they doing this? Like what is important? Because there's nothing worse, I think, as an engineering team than having work come in and you're like, I'm just doing work to do work. But like doing work to see like, hey, this is what this is actually going to solve in terms of a business problem is really, really interesting.
What aspect of the flip side, the time you spend remotely, do you feel like your team or Grainger broadly is particularly good at?
We meet every single morning to kind of talk through like, what have we done? What are blockers? What are risks? What's in progress right now? Any kind of fun things that we've learned. We have retro. We have tech huddle. Meaning a tech huddle or like mob coding where we work on things that are maybe more challenging. Maybe we solve a problem together. Maybe we like do a little bit of refactoring just because it provides a good learning experience for all members of the team. And then we do a lot of pair programming. This is like the core component of most of the engineer's day is their work on the engineering effort for the individual teams. The teams that I work with switch twice a week. Sometimes they switch more if there's like a need to. You know, we have PTO coming up, and so maybe someone's out and we get a new pair for that day instead. That is the core of their time. And then we use Teams and Slack for our communication. And so that, I think, is the big difference between like remote and in-person is like how much asynchronous communication we're doing.
I'm wondering, when you refer to pairing and the fact that the core part of the team's time spent on delivery is through pair programming, what does that really mean?
The goal behind it, I think, from my perspective, is for context sharing, for quality, and for, like, you know, not working in isolation. And I think there's, like, a very specific important part of, like, socialization that comes from pairing as well. So, like, it serves multiple purposes. And we can do this in any number of ways. So being part of a pair doesn't mean you have to be glued to your pair. What it does mean, though, is that, like, when you're actively coding, ideally, you should be working with someone else and engaged with that person. And that engagement can take a lot of different forms. So that engagement could be that you are doing, like, a driver-navigator type of approach. It could mean that you're doing a ping pong type of approach. Hopefully, you're leveraging some form of test-driven development as part of your pairing approach. And how much you do it, I think, depends on the pair. So I've encouraged, when people are new to the team and we have someone new join, to talk through what it means to pair with that person when you pair with them for the first time, and kind of setting expectations with your pair when you start for the day. So, like, maybe you're someone who really, like, works well for, like, 30 minutes at a time. And so thinking about, like, hey, I need to take short stops at, like, every 30 minutes, and that works for me. Or maybe I can go a little bit longer. I can do an hour, and that works for me. But figuring out what that looks like and figuring out what type of interaction, if you're learning, if you're someone who's, like, a brand new engineer and you're being paired with someone more senior, thinking about having that person drive more to kind of get them comfortable with the feel of the code and making sure that they're engaged and kind of, like, not checking out. Thinking about, like, how do you talk to each other when you're pairing? How do you listen to what the other person is saying? So setting all those expectations up when you start pairing for the day, I think, is super important so that you can find the right groove with the different people that you work with.
It really sounds like you treat pair programming as a skill in and of itself.
I think it is. I think it also really develops your communication skills significantly, because you have to be able to understand what someone is telling you in either case, whether you are driving or whether you are, like, kind of, like, navigating. You have to be able to tell someone what you're thinking and be able to explain to them in a way that they understand. That communication, I think, then that skill set translates to, how do I talk to engineering managers? How do I tell product what is the bug that we're working on? How do I share out my learnings about said new technology in a blog or in a lunch and learn? I think a lot of the skills for communication build from that interaction. And then I think it does support their technical skills too, for sure. If you're someone who is less senior and you're pairing with someone who is senior, you learn a lot from that. And I think actually the vice versa, like the reverse happens. Like if you're very senior and you're working with someone who is a more junior, you can learn a lot about, like, by having to explain to someone who doesn't have that same foundational skill set. So I think it does support the technical growth as well.
Yeah. I mean, clearly you're a big proponent of this. Not all engineering managers are. I mean, there's classic arguments for management around why pair programming would not be management's preference. Do you have any stories or anecdotes that you could share about where you've seen pairing make a big difference, either on individuals, on the team, on the output?
We had a kickoff recently, and, like, looking at how that team worked and how successful they were in this last initiative, and I think a large portion of it was due to pairing. We had to kick off some new work. It was actually fairly challenging. Involved some pretty complex, like, data integration, munging, and standing up a bunch of stream processors as well. So, like, some non-trivial work in terms of the level of effort. You know, we had our traditional kickoff. We also had a follow-up session, a technical session with myself and the tech lead and the engineering team talking through in more detail what we needed to do.
Were those both in person?
No, so this team is actually a half in-person, half, like, remote team. So, you know, we talked through all of this work that had to be done, and then each engineer in the team refined stories. So, like, it was, the tech lead did no refinement of the stories this time. So the engineers did it. They put in the effort to understand kind of the context of what was going on. And then we started to pull those stories into our Ready for Dev column and pick them up. And these stories relied on an understanding of some of the previous work that we had already put in place. And so for that specifically, I asked engineers who had that context to anchor with some new engineers who didn't fully have that context. Right. They had context on the new work, but not on the original implementation that we had in place. As the team worked together and picked things up and did this refinement of stories, I remember thinking to myself, I was like, man, I was like, they are really humming along. Like they are moving through this work. Like they are getting it done, and it's quality. Like the number of like resulting like bugs or issues that were kind of popping up, there were almost none. And I was like, wow, you know, and then when I had a chance to really look at like the lagging indicators of success, which would have been like, you know, our DORA metrics of like, hey, what was our cycle time? Over a 6-week period, I watched as like that cycle time was like incredibly consistent and very low. So we were deploying at least once a day. The cycle time was like under 5 days for almost all these stories. The work was done really quickly. And I think that was like a combination of factors, but like thinking about like who had context, make sure everyone knew the new context, and then the pairing sessions, the status updates were really, really well thought out. They were able to talk like very clearly to like where they were kind of working within a story. It was really impressive. And a lot of that I think had to do with like pairing up of like the context of like the old implementation with like the new for the engineers.
Before you could see the lagging indicators, what gave you that feeling that the team was really humming along?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was to do with the communication and the status updates that the team was giving. So you'd see a story come in and the engineers would talk through it, have a dust check after they were done with it. But like in the status updates, they were like, oh, we made it through this part and this part. And they were very communicative in the channel, asking a lot of questions. But like overall, like they were able to answer a lot of their own questions too. And so just kind of like, I remember seeing things being picked up and moving along kind of very seamlessly. And so I still need to dig into this. And when I look at this, I'm like, man, how do I see like in the moment that I know something rather than this like kind of like gut feeling of like, wow, I feel like things are moving fast, but like, I'm not entirely sure. And so I probably could have looked at the cycle time as well, right in that moment. But, you know, it was definitely more of a feeling of like the engineers really knowing, really understanding what they were doing and really feeling confident in the work they were doing.
That's really cool. It sounds like the status update moments gave you visibility into that contributed to that gut feeling. How do you approach status updates?
Ideally, the status updates should be short, but have valuable information. So, you know, for example, I can do like a bad status update would be like, I'm stuck and I've been working on this for a while, or like, you know, but that doesn't really give you any insight into like, where are you stuck? What have you tried? What are you working on? And so a valuable status update in that case would be, hey, I'm stuck. I've tried reaching out to the platform team. They gave me this. I've, you know, copied the team on the thread, and then I tried this instead. And so my next course of action is to try this set of things. And that kind of like lets you know kind of what have they tried and what are they working towards. And so then other engineers can say, oh, did you consider, you know, X, Y, and Z? That's valuable, right? Not too long.
Yeah. Well, where do these take place and how often do they take place?
They usually happen in standups, definitely for sure. But then the team has gotten really great at giving like also asynchronous updates. We really try to encourage this of like, hey, ask questions in Slack. Questions are great. No questions are dumb. You learn something interesting, share it with the team in Slack and just drop that there. And so that's happening a lot. And that's, I think, a different form of a status update, but also equally as valuable.
So you do daily standups, and in those daily standups, there's, you know, people are providing status updates of where things are at. Who attends the standups?
So it's our engineering team. The engineering manager attends the standups and any QEs that we have for the team. So it depends on the team, whether or not we have QEs, and the product owner. And so pretty much we all attend daily. There are times when, like, say, myself or the product manager will need to miss, but for the most part, we attend on a daily basis as well. Occasionally, we might ask someone else to join if we have some information that might be needed from another team or, like, from architecture. We might ask our domain architect to join.
And QE is quality engineer, is that right?
Yes, yes.
So how many folks are in each one of these?
Depends on the team. Our engineering teams tend to be between 6 and 8 individuals of like the engineers themselves. And then you add in quality engineers, product and engineering manager. So you probably have somewhere between like 7 to 12 people that might be in the meeting.
Yeah, stand-up is a topic I'm infinitely fascinated by because every single person I talk to approaches stand-up differently. And nobody I've spoken with yet, at least, feels like the way that they do stand-up is really what excellent looks like. Maybe you feel differently. I'm endlessly curious to hear how folks approach it in pursuit of better.
Yeah, we've gone through some iterations of stand-up. There was a period of time where our stand-ups were getting very long. And so we tried to be pretty clear about what things we want to cover in stand-up and what things might be better topics for outside of stand-up. We do a thing where we go through all of our status updates first. And as we go through that, we say, hey, do you have something extra you want to talk about, which we call a QC, which I think we call quality circle, quality check. We call it QC. That comes after we deal with announcements and any pair swapping that we want to take care of for that morning. So we get the fast things out of the way first, and then we can go into the QC. And we try to make sure that, like, for those QCs, like, who needs to be in them? Like, do we need product input as part of this QC? Oh, we also have our engineering business analyst. Like, do we need our EBA to be involved? And if we don't, like, making sure we give them the space back for time in their schedule. And if we have a QC that's going to go long, you know, making sure that, like, hey, our stand-ups are scheduled for 30 minutes. People need to drop at the end of that 30 minutes, drop. Go do the things you need to do. And you know, people can continue those conversations, but it doesn't have to necessarily be the whole team. It's not perfect, I don't think, but we've made some improvements.
A topic you mentioned earlier, just at the start of the conversation, is onboarding. Onboarding new team members in a remote setting, in a hybrid setting, is different than onboarding somebody in person, and there's pros and cons to that. And so I'd love to hear how you think about onboarding new team members, as it sounds like there's a decent amount of that takes place.
So in general, for engineers, we have two different kinds of onboarding. We have the onboarding that is like, how do I get my system up and running?
Where the tools technical and, stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the technical thing. And actually our onboarding for that is pretty solid in terms of like, here's the list of things you need to go through for onboarding. This is the checklist of like requests that you have to fill out. And here are the tools that we're going to work with. And here's how you're going to install and pull all the different code bases that we have and all that kind of fun stuff. That's not bad. And there might be some small things here and there that like we try to keep it up to date, but pretty straightforward. I think the biggest challenge of onboarding is context. You're coming into a new domain and there are the business rules of your system. Like, who are your users? What do the different teams support within this business system? And it's constantly evolving. And so I have started working on putting together like PowerPoints for the different teams that like I support and trying to keep the business rules up to date in those PowerPoints. I have one PowerPoint for one team done, and everything else is unfortunately like in my head.
and this is not great. How many teams?
There's four teams that I work with.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's this kind of funny challenge of we do put a lot of things in our readmes. We do capture design decisions when we make them. We do have a lot of documentation in Confluence, but it's really kind of unrealistic to expect someone to come on and onboard and read all those design docs and then put together a picture of like where your system is at currently.
Yeah.
And so it's also very difficult, though, at the same time, as your business rules evolve, to keep those PowerPoints up to date, right? Like, it's non-trivial, and it's really no one person's job, but when it's no one person's job, it's very difficult to get it done. And so I'm in this like partially completed state. So now what ends up happening is I have this one deck that I use, and for everything else, I walk through it from memory, and I whiteboard it out with people. It's not awesome. And there's also, of course, the part where they're like immersive onboarding, because they go in, they go into the code, they talk through it with their pair. So the pair does provide a set of onboarding as well of like, oh yeah, this is this bit of the code and this is what this is doing. This is who it's serving. But I think it would be helpful always to have a bigger picture before you like have that immersive learning. So I don't think I'm doing it great.
Nobody I've spoken to feels really, really solid about the way that they approach onboarding, which again, makes it an interesting topic for me to dig into because I hear the different approaches that folks take, the things that they feel good about, the things that they wish were better. If you were to change anything about the way that y'all approach onboarding, what would you change?
if I had a series of videos for onboarding that were somehow magically always up to date with the evolution, that would be like a great starting point, I think, for onboarding, with the expectation that after you've kind of gone through those, that someone should like watch those, write down questions. And then those questions would be conversation topics that you would have with like your tech lead or an engineering manager or another engineer on the team to talk through like, hey, I was watching this and I saw so-and-so does this as part of our system. What about this? And to have those as like foundational videos, I think would be great. And then also like maybe an in-person session to walk through like the actual system itself, like go to the websites, use the app, do these kinds of things in QA to like understand how it all works. And of course, there is the pair programming aspect of it, which I think just reinforces those business contexts at the coding level.
It's like starting with a high fidelity body of content in the form of video that gives you the context that you need to then slowly narrow the scope down to the specific areas that you'd be working in the form of pair programming.
Yeah. The part that I haven't figured out is how to like create videos that can keep up to date as things change, because it's just too much effort to re-record and then like I have to splice and dice the videos, and I don't have that kind of patience right now or time.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that either. If I speak to anybody who does or does this really well, yeah, of course,
let
these
me
interviews,
know, because I could really use it.
I will absolutely follow up. We've talked about a couple of places where things were working really well, where you feel really solid about the practices that folks have. I also like to unpack areas that maybe aren't going as well. Could you share any stories of where you felt that a team dynamic really broke down?
There was a period of time where one of the teams I was working with, we were, you know, moving along, producing the work that we needed to produce. There were a lot of challenges with the team being able to like triage and understand the data of the system that they were working with. And I was kind of banging my head against a wall trying to look at this and be like, why? What is happening with this team? Like, why are they struggling to understand, like to dig into the issues that like are popping up with the code that we like just wrote? And like, why are they struggling to get at the data that they need in order to like to do this? What are we doing in our process that's making this so difficult for them? And how do I make it better? I ended up doing something that I don't like really prefer to do, which is I took a very heavy-handed approach with the team and basically said, you no longer have a validation column in your like software development cycle. So like, you know, you pick up something and ready for dev, it goes into progress, you do the dev complete work, it goes into validation, and then it goes off to like ready for production. And like, you know, if we think about the cycle there. And this is also kind of, this is like our ticket movement, if we think about it that way, rather than like our deployment process. I basically said, there's no more validation. There's only you as the engineers that own like the whole cycle. And so the goal of this is that you as an engineer will own the development, you'll own the understanding of the data, you'll own pushing it to production and making sure that when it pushes to production that like that it has like the quality that you expect. And if we have problems, making sure that we can roll back or, you know, fix forward, whatever. And that we're not going to like do this with QE kind of like in the tail end of our cycle. We have other opportunities for QE to influence us from the beginning. So moving QE to the front of our cycle.
Sure.
And so as part of that, because I also had noticed like we were having bugs, we were having like acceptance criteria conditions that were being missed. That very heavy-handed approach I took was like, for your desk checks, you can do them asynchronously. So you record them, you have to have your pair in it, and you have to have one other engineer in it. So the idea of like, I have to talk through the work I just did with my pair, with another engineer who doesn't maybe have as much context on it, and review every single AC and review every single technical note to make sure that we haven't missed anything. And this was very, again, I keep saying the word heavy-handed. It was very, very heavy-handed. And it felt very uncomfortable to do that because I really like to have like the teams interact more organically. And I was very surprised. The team was like, sure, we'll do this. And we had some like bumps along the road where like we realized that like they did miss notes in like the tickets when they were reading them and things like that. But after that period of time, what you saw was that the engineers really, really were owning, they were owning the code. They were owning the context. Their understanding of the data went substantially up because they had to make sure they had the data ready to be able to validate, you know, through the different like environments that we had. And they were really working with QE in a different way that allowed them to understand that data. And QE still ended up being like kind of like a source of truth for like understanding the data in the system, especially like the broader system that we integrate with. But it made a difference in terms of how they were thinking about the integrations we have with other systems. And so ultimately it worked out like well, and now it's just a part of the process. Like there's really no, we have a validation column that sits in Jira, but like it kind of just like moves right through it. Like we don't really do anything with it. It was uncomfortable though. And I think they were kind of surprised by like, why, you know, and so like having to give the context of like what I was seeing from like a different perspective and what I was concerned about. But I think because we have trust with this team, they were willing to work with that.
What do you take from that situation?
If I was to do this differently going forward, I think what I would want to do is say, here are the things that I'm seeing, team. Here are some ideas I have. And what are you seeing? And which one of these ideas are you willing to like to try out to see if it works? And so maybe really reframing this with like an experimentation mindset with the team rather than kind of like the heavy-handed approach that I took originally. It didn't, like I said, it did work, but like it's, I don't think that's how I would want to continue doing things in the future. And so I think that going forward, what I took away is that there's a different opportunity for communication on my side, but that as a team, making sure that we're always open to changing how we do things is like, I think, core to our like engineering principles.
Yeah. And there's so many different ways that you can affect change. Mm-hmm. And one of them is a heavy-handed approach. One of them is a more collaborative approach, which it sounds like you would lean towards if you were to do this again.
Yeah. And so that to me was kind of a story of like, I think a challenge, we did get through it, but a failure on my side in terms of how I'd want to interact with the team and how I would change it going forward.
Doubling down on challenge a little bit, I'm wondering what's been the toughest part of being hybrid and partially remote for you personally?
There's a certain amount, I think, in my position of feeling a little bit isolated. I'm in daily interactions with the team. We chat quite a bit and we have one-to-ones. But on the whole, my daily interactions are through a bunch of meetings that I kind of bounce to from one-to-one. And so in a sense, that is very isolating. But in hindsight, I think I would kind of feel that way in person too. I go to a bunch of different meetings and I get to integrate and talk to and communicate with my team members in between those. When I'm working remotely, I don't have that option. I might be able to send up a Slack message or something, but I don't quite get that like endorphin, I guess, from like an in-person communication. That's part of it. I think another part is trying to check in with team members and make sure that they're okay remotely is harder. You know, trying to gauge someone's reactions through video is way different than doing it in person. And I feel like I've developed a different set of skills to do it, but I don't think they're quite as good as like just like the natural, ooh, something seems off with you. Are you okay? I can't get that quite as easily through video. As a note about isolation, a lot of the teams I work with, we have a game night that we do once a month to try and make sure that we're doing something together that's like fun and kind of reduces that like remote isolation feeling. We found a lot of online games that we have enjoyed playing, and it like allows us to see different sides of each other that we maybe don't normally see.
I think the once a month cadence is good. I've heard some folks who try and do that every week. Ooh. And it just becomes a little bit of a chore.
Yeah. And we don't want it to be a chore. We want it to be something. And it's optional. Like you don't have to join if it's a bad day for you, you know, whatever. But like we have a program at Grainger that like rotates new engineers through different teams to give them exposure. And some of those engineers have gone to other teams and taken the game night with them. And it's been fun to see that pop up in other areas.
Good indicator of success.
Yeah. Yes.
What's one question or thing about remote work or hybrid work for that matter that you feel like is still unanswered?
How do you deal with alignment? I think this is a hard question actually in person. I think it's additionally hard when you do remote of like, how do you ensure alignment with the things that you are trying to do among people from different organizations? And how do you communicate that? Like, are you including the right people? Are you communicating in the right space? Do you use like Teams? Do you use Slack? Do you use Confluence? Do you use Mural? Do you use like the plethora of tools that you have? I don't know. I don't think there's a right answer. And I think that it depends on the people you're working with. But that's something that I think we're still kind of trying to hammer out.
Yeah, most folks are. So you're not alone in that respect. Good deal. Well, with that, thank you so much, Rachel. I really appreciate you being generous with your time and your insights. folks would like to learn more or reconnect with you or Greater specifically, where should they go?
LinkedIn is actually probably the best place to to get a hold of me. I think it's just rachel.trotta is my LinkedIn. That's usually the best place.
Well, we'll put a link in the show notes as well for folks.
Awesome.
So thank you. Thank you so much and hope to chat again soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @Tuple on X or visit distributed.fm.